Hi, this is Aaron Newcomb, and on this episode of Floss Weekly, Jonathan Bennett joins me to talk to Will Hayes from LucidWorks. LucidWorks is an enterprise search engine platform that's built on the open source Apache Solr project. It's coming up right now, and you're not going to want to miss it right here on Floss Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 401, recorded on August 30th, 2016. LucidWorks. Hey, everybody, it's time for Floss Weekly, the show where we talk about open source projects and the people who make them. I'm Aaron Newcomb, your host for today, covering for Randall, who's still out of the, he's still recovering, and we wish him a speedy recovery and hope that he's feeling a lot better. I also am joined today by a lovely co-host. That's Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, how's it going?
Good. I'm not sure how I feel about being called lovely by someone other than my wife, and even that sounds a little strange. But it's good to be here.
Good. Well, you are lovely. You got a lovely goatee going on there, so you know you got that going for you.
I even trimmed it up just for today.
Nice. Yeah, I don't know where that joke started. I don't know if Randall just said that one time or what, but now, at least when I'm on the show, we always do it. We always do the lovely co-hosts. So anyway, thanks for joining today and helping me out as we talk about our topic of the day, which is going to be fun. Oh, before I forget, I need to do this because this phone is off the hook. It really is off the hook. Whenever I don't take my phone off the hook and we do these shows, somebody always calls me, and that's the only time I get phone calls. And I've got this really loud 1940s Western Electric rotary telephone next to me, and it's so loud. So let's see. It's either that or the dog barking. We'll see which one happens today. It won't be the phone because I just took it off the hook. We'll see if the dog barks. And, of course, I'm coming to you today from my home office, as usual. All that stuff in the background's not mine, belongs to my wife. You can't see all the great stuff I have in front of me, Raspberry Pis and chip computers and Arduinos and soldering irons and all kinds of cool gadgets. But that's where I'm speaking to you from today. Jonathan, how about you? Are you also in a home office?
I'm here at the home office in Lawton, Oklahoma, yes. And if you want to get a look at all the cool stuff on his desk, a couple of weeks ago, we did an open hardware episode.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Yeah, that was a fun episode. We'll have to do that again sometime. And it was cool because we all had different things to talk about, and Guillermo had different types of equipment, you know, different boards than I did, and so we were able to kind of do a little quiz show on the boards and stuff. Yeah, if you missed that one, definitely go check it out, because we'd like to do, at least I'd like to do some more open hardware-related things, maybe bring on people from like the Raspberry Pi Foundation or Arduino or wherever, and have them talk about open hardware and what the latest developments are in that universe, because I think it really does fit in well with our topic here of free Libre open source software. So if you'd like to see that, reach out to me, let me know, and we'll see if we can get some more of those types of shows going for you. Also, I've got two cups of coffee today because I was almost done with one of them. So I've got both... Two cups, so I've got my refill already, so I don't have to get up and go get more coffee in the middle and hope that our guest talks long enough to cover my absence. So we're good to go. Speaking of our guest, let's go ahead and get ready to bring him on. We're going to be speaking to Will Hayes, who's the CEO of LucidWorks, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, LucidWorks and the software that they develop. LucidWorks is a San Francisco-based enterprise search company, and Will began his technology career at 18 as a software engineer at Genentech, a local company here in the Bay Area. Later in his 20s, he joined big data analysis company Splunk. Yeah, it's very familiar with Splunk, where he spent 8 years in a variety of roles across engineering and business development, opening new markets in 20 countries and helping build the company into a publicly traded 1,500-person organization whose true disruption laid the foundation for the big data movement that we know today. So we'll talk about how he joined LucidWorks and all of that good stuff. So let's bring them on right now. Will Hayes, thanks for joining the show today.
Hi, thanks for having us on today.
Yeah, definitely. So where are you speaking to us from?
So I am in our lovely headquarters in San Francisco. I'm actually in a real office.
Are you guys, where are you guys located? Are you guys in Soma or?
Yeah, so we're right outside of South Park, if you know the area, a couple blocks up from the AT&T baseball stadium.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know it well. I've done business with lots of companies there over the years. So
they're all right here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all of these. I mean, you wouldn't believe all the companies there. I think isn't like Weebly there? Splunk is just down the road, right?
Right down the street. GitHub, right around the corner. This is definitely a heavily trafficked tech area, if you will, although all of San Francisco is starting to feel that way.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to play, you have a great video on your website that I want to play in just a minute. But before I do, just give us the 20,000 foot overview of what LucidWorks is. And later we're going to get into the conversation about how that ties into open source and what the relationship is there and all that kind of stuff. But just to set the stage here for our viewers, what is LucidWorks all about?
Sure. So at our foundation, what we do is we deliver relevant data to users. And so this provides access to enterprises to all the information, corpus of knowledge that they have stored, be it inside of document repositories. You've got things on the web. You've got feeds of information, aggregating that information, but actually providing access to it. And so we provide a search technology, which we've extended from an open source base, which was really the foundation of the company, Apache Solr. We've extended that now to address a lot of these enterprise challenges when it comes to building applications in and around their data, primarily around the paradigm of access and ranking. And so I could talk a bit as we get into it about relevancy and importance and sort of how search is kind of playing a really important role in the application story when it comes to big data.
Great. Well, we definitely want to talk about that. And it sounds like a real enterprise play here, which sometimes people can think is boring, but it's actually really, really important when you look at especially the relevance of data to today's companies. Absolutely. And how they use that data to be competitive and to, get to market faster than their competitors for a certain project or product or whatever it is. And also just making contact with their customers, making sure that they know their customers better, all that kind of stuff. It really is important. And all the big companies today are doing it. So we definitely want to talk about that. One of your big, maybe it's your keystone product, I don't know, but I think it's called Fusion. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so what Fusion is it's really an application server, again, built on top of Apache Solr, but integrates all of the capabilities that you need for these enterprise applications. So there's sort of three tiers of value that we look at and that we build out or try to articulate through our offering. The first one is simply data acquisition. So you've got data that's sitting behind a variety of repositories. We've got over 75 different connectors. We support over 200 different file types when it comes to the parsing and really making sense of that information, which is an important part of indexing the data, obviously, is you want to have all the appropriate metadata headers, things like authors and those kinds of things. We provide a data processing layer that's actually the most scalable and expedient platform on the market today. And so we can retrieve and store billions of records a day. We have customers that are serving up hundreds of millions of transactions coming off of our system. And on top of that, we offer a data retrieval capability, which goes beyond just simple query. Of course, you can do the natural language query. You can request statistics and aggregations and analytics and things of that nature. But being a search company and being a group of search experts, we focus a lot more then on the relevancy of that data and how users can define that relevancy or curate a data experience. And so topics around that technology would be things like e-commerce, right? So when you're out there shopping online, you're being served a number of recommendations, things that are very specific to you, things that are specific to what you've done in the history. Our technology allows those retailers to really craft what that data experience should be and provide the right contextual information that's going to provoke an action from the user. And again, in the retail context, it's always easy to understand that because it means that they're going to transact. But if something like customer service, you may be trying to resolve an issue, keep somebody from picking up the phone and calling in. If you're trying to analyze fraud, it may be by aggregating all of this information and ranking things that are the most suspicious or need to be reviewed. And so this idea, as we get into big data, of what makes data relevant, what makes data important, is becoming increasingly more important as we kind of move into this realm of just lots and lots of information at our disposal.
Great. That's a perfect explanation. And I wanted to play the video on your website because I think it kind of puts the, it like shows the importance to customers, the importance to businesses. And this is kind of a marketing video, being in solutions marketing, you know, you can, you recognize these things from a long ways away, but, but I did want to play it because it does kind of explain what it is and also show how customers are using it. So John, if you could just play that, it's a real short video.
I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for Fusion.
So last year we launched our flagship product, Fusion.
Fusion is built off of two primary open source engines, if you will. Apache Solr being the main storage and retrieval and ranking engine. And then Apache Spark is this incredible distributed computation capability.
Using the LucidWorks Fusion platform, it made it a lot easier than going under the hood, all the command line routines. Everything was in a nice graphical user interface for me to do what I needed to do and leverage all of the different content source connectors.
It allows our staff, which might not have all of those search expertise, to sort of be bigger than we actually are. Even though we are a large company, our development staff can be a little bit constrained at times, and certainly we don't have as much in-house expertise in the search space as we do with LucidWorks.
LucidWorks Fusion is our easy button. It puts the power of search and driving that algorithm in the hands of the business people and the subject matter experts.
It comes with out-of-box crawlers, connectors and stuff. You don't need to actually spend more time writing your own custom code.
For the biggest impact, it's freed us up from dealing with mundane tasks with development. You don't have to be a developer anymore. You can stop thinking like a propeller head and start thinking like a scientist.
Our biggest inspiration now is coming from the customers that are pushing us into these directions to help them solve the next generation of data-driven problems that are going to transform the way they do business.
There you go. So that's LucidWorks. And you kind of answered this already, both in the video, I think, in your question. But we do have a question from the chat room, which we'd love to take. And I'm just going to put it out there now, which this is from Daw Desktop. He says, well, the obvious question is, how does this compare to corporate Google search? I've used corporate Google search. I think you kind of answered this. It's more about analyzing the data and reading the metadata and all that kind of stuff. But maybe take that on, if you will. I mean, how would you compare corporate Google, you know, a Google box sitting in your data center somewhere searching all your stuff with what you're doing?
Right. So great question. And actually, what some folks may or may not be aware of is Google's actually end-of-lifing that yellow box that we all came to know and love over the last 14 years, shifting a lot more of their enterprise, or actually shifting their entire enterprise strategy up to the cloud. But still, regardless of whether you're comfortable moving things to the Google Cloud or you prefer an on-prem solution, the real difference comes down to transparency under the hood. And so the Google search appliance, when that came into existence, did a really great job at solving the problem of, hey, I've got some data. Let me just point my search box at it, index that data, serve up a page, and I'm going to rely on all of the algorithmic goodness that Google was willing to share as part of this offering. Now, of course, that's not going to be the same set of experiments and algorithms and obviously billions of user signal data that you're capturing on Google.com, but there's some sophistication in terms of how they've integrated their ranking capabilities. The issue comes down to that sort of black box nature of it. And while in a departmental level deployment, if you're doing an internal enterprise search type of project, it might be good enough. I've got tens of thousands of documents. I've got a handful of users. More or less, the ranking that I'm getting back from the algorithms that Google provides is good enough, and I can move forward. When I start thinking about sort of serving up the most actionable information, so like in the customer service use case, I want to ensure that the most relevant document based on everything that I know about my customers, about my defects, is being delivered at the time that the user asks the query, I need to actually get under the hood and start to define what that ranking is going to be. Or if I want to curate a specific experience through an online shopping website, I've got very specific requirements about how I want that data to behave as part of that user experience. With the Google box, you don't have the power to sort of override that default behavior and prescribe very specific data experiences for your customers. So we see a lot of customers, if I take Red Hat for an example, they were running the Google box as part of their customer service website, were having an issue with people simply not getting to relevant information and resolving their issues, decided to take a look at LucidWorks, went into a deployment, and immediately after deployment saw a 30% increase in self-serviced issues because users were getting to that more relevant information. And Red Hat had the ability to actually curate what they wanted those results to be based off of known defects, based off of customer customer inventories, products that they have purchased, products that they're subscribed to, things of that nature. So it's all about increasing that efficiency. And a lot of customers see that with LucidWorks, they get total control over that experience versus just getting a sort of almost good enough out of the box experience that they got with Google originally.
Yeah. And then that's something that I think that's a great example. I mean, I'm always I recently had some changes I need to make with Comcast, and I went to their website and I don't know. I guess I'm just a sucker. I'm like, you know, companies will eventually figure out how to give me relevant data. So I go to their search site and I try to type in, you know, my problem, and I never, ever get the thing I'm looking for, ever. It's always some like very generic thing. Do you want help setting up new service? Like, no, I don't want help setting up new service, you know? And so I think this is really, really relevant. Now, do you also do, I mean, you've talked about a couple different things here. You talk about customer data, you talked about documents, for example. So I'm used to, in the enterprise land, I'm used to dealing with services like Documentum in the past or things like that that do document curation. But do you do that as well as just this ranking of relevant generic data?
So, yeah, so we handle, I mean, it's interesting. If I had a whiteboard here, I would draw the whole continuum for you. But in a simple sense, you can think about, I'll call it a search application, but really everything is a search application. Anything that's data-driven, you want access to that data. You want that access to be as natural as possible. And both the inability to use natural language and poor relevancy are the two things that probably frustrate users the most. Right. And so your example of looking at your cable provider, trying to get to some information that, you know, is sitting there that, you know, you want the answer for, you have an intention, and being able to map that intention to results can be difficult at times. So your question specifically, we take in, you know, everything from kind of your basic, I have a bunch of documents, I want to make them accessible. I kind of consider that sort of level one of search, right? So I've chosen a platform, I've deployed it. So with Fusion, very quickly, within, you know, 5 to 10 minutes time, I can point it at my Documentum, at my Jive, at my SharePoint, wherever my data may be, I can start to ingest that data. Now, that's sort of phase one, and in some cases, you might declare a victory there. But what happens immediately after that, just like your experience with the cable provider, users start asking questions. They say, hey, look, I can't get to this information that I know that I need, or I'm sure that there's something sitting there in the corpus of knowledge that I'm just not able to surface for whatever reasons. Or in your case, I have a very specific intention, and it seems pretty obvious based on the way that I'm asking the question, yet you're not taking me to anything nearly relevant for what I'm trying to do. So from level one, which is really about your data and your applications, you kind of want to move now to sort of a level two, which is all about relevancy. So now I want to start to actually tune that relevancy. I want to start to provide that curated experience. And so that's kind of how the evolution works. And then on the third level is sort of as you get to kind of the more smart search, I'll call it, or smart application, your Siri or your Watson or things of that nature, where I can ask it questions, where it's far more predictive, where it can start to push me notifications. So I think a great example of this is something like a Google Now, where you're constantly running contextual searches based on activities, locations, calendar, any other inputs that they have, and they're able to proactively start to surface this information. And so more and more people in the enterprise are thinking about this continuum. The one big change that I'd say that's happened in the enterprise that is causing a lot of our customers to react is expectations. You know, back in the day, I remember when I started my career, just how funky these systems were. They were brittle. They only spoke SQL. I couldn't search them by any means, right? Whereas today, with the way that people are interacting with technology, especially as a consumer and your mobile devices and all of these things, you're starting to experience things through Facebook and Instagram and online ordering and Netflix. And as you get to work, you sort of say, wait a minute, why the heck is it that I have to scroll to the third page every single time? You know who I am. I look for the same information every time that I come into work. So that increasing expectation from what we experience in sort of consumer land is adding a lot more pressure now within the enterprise. What's funny about that is I think there's some traditional consumer services like the one that you mentioned that need to sort of move along this curve as well and could benefit from some evolution there.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we have an internal one of the reasons I asked about documents is it's a little self-serving, but where I work at NetApp, we have an internal document system, and it doesn't always work the way you expect it to. So I'm kind of thinking, maybe this is a solution, because you're always like you say, I have a specific role. I come into the office, I open up this page, I should see stuff that is relevant to me, and I don't always, and it's frustrating. Yeah. I'm going to put this in the back of my head and look at it more from later on when we're done with this and I go back to work. I'm going to take a look at this a little bit more deeply.
Sunnyvale is right down the street, so we have to
stop. It's not far, right? Yeah. It's not far. Just get on Caltrain and you're there. I know what I wanted to ask. So when you were describing this, it kind of sounded almost – and I know you worked at Splunk, and I mean it almost seems like the model that you've developed is similar in some ways to the MapReduce model, right? I mean, maybe applied a little bit differently, but it almost sounds similar. Is it? Am I reading into that or no?
There are certain components. So one of the things, and again, this is we'll have to do a whiteboard talk at one of these points. But one of the ways that we manage that relevancy, or we're able to drive that kind of contextual experience, is through a facility that we call signals. And a signal is really anything that we can capture that you think might be relevant to your data. So a really easy example of that would be that a user comes to your site. They type in a term. Let's take a shopping example because we all live that every day. Let's say I come to your website and I type in iPhone. And a result comes up with, 10 blue links, typical search experience. But at the very bottom is the iPhone. I'm an Android person, so I don't know the latest. But the iPhone 6, let's call it, handset that you were looking for. Now, the first few results that you're seeing are all cables and cases and things that really aren't as relevant as that handset when you're searching only for the term iPhone. So a signal might be the user typed in iPhone and then clicked this number 9 document, which was the iPhone handset. Now, let's say that I take in 10 million users a day and 85% of them are exhibiting that behavior. Well, I want to then process that behavior to better rank the data next time. And that's something that we do sort of in a batch job or in real time. So you might run something similar to a MapReduce where you say, I've got tens of millions of signals coming across hundreds of thousands of searches from all of these users, and I want to run some kind of aggregation to determine a better ranking for every term that's coming in. And I might expand that beyond just terms. I might say term and what role in the organization are they, right? If we take like an enterprise use case, or give me some demographic information, anything that you want to process as part of that aggregation of information to determine that ranking. And so we run that similar to a MapReduce in that we can do that in batch. We can definitely offload that to Hadoop. More and more, though, we've been using Spark to run that computation in real time, which is an interesting advantage that it's given to our users now that deal with a lot of high throughput scenarios where they want the ability to kind of respond as things are changing, even down to, say, the 10-minute granularity versus, waiting for a month's worth of data and then aggregating that data and rolling it out like maybe a retailer would do.
That's awesome. And one quick question, and I want to let Jonathan come in and ask some questions as well. But this is really interesting to me just because it's kind of part of my day job as well.
Yeah.
So are you caching all of this information for each user individually? Are you constantly churning in the background? I mean, where's all this stuff getting stored? Is it just pointers to relevant information so you don't have to store all that information? I'm just thinking like, that's a lot of what you're talking about. Even the more simplistic examples that you're talking about is a lot of data to go through, to churn through. Are you constantly in the background, running jobs to try to find this relevant data, or how does that work?
Again, it's very use case specific. And so we have the ability via Spark and other mechanisms that we've got under the hood to run those aggregations in real time. And so we could be, start driving that relevancy as activity is happening. In a lot of cases, what users, and again, I'll use retail as a good example, they like to take broader sample sets because you never know when there might just be a small trend. Let's say somebody blurts something out on TV and a handful of the population had seen that and they run to the web and they want to go look for that item or something to that nature. Well, if that's occurring over a longer trended period, that might be something significant that you want to react to. If you have a burst of activity within, like, say, 30 seconds, or somebody's even potentially gaming your system, then you may not want to react in real time necessarily to those relevancy adjustments. So, again, it's very use case specific. But in our world, we can handle both cases. Now, we do some really interesting things architecturally. One of the things that we do is we actually use in the back end Apache Solr as our database, as our data store. So of course, as we index content, as you search content, we have that capability. It's a primary use case for our platform. But in the background, we're actually taking advantage of the flexibility and the scale of search to process all of that information, to aggregate that information in nearly real time, and to do it across a very massive scale. Now, let me maybe just talk about Splunk for a quick second and why I'm here at Lucidworks and what I got excited about. Because, you know, enterprise search as a technology has been around for a long time, right? We've probably been doing this, I mean, gosh, there's vendors that go back into the mid-90s even. And so this wasn't necessarily something new, especially now, but even let's take in 2005 when we started with Splunk, because the idea at Splunk was simple. It was saying, wow, there's all this data that sits behind all these different devices and logs and servers and everything throughout the data center, and the ways that people go and investigate this information is broken. What if we could just Google the data center? And what I'm really proud about the work at Splunk and what you see in the industry today, and I think which has even opened up opportunities for more traditional search vendors like Lucid, is that this idea of search as an access paradigm, not just search as a way to go look at, you know, highly unstructured human-generated content in the way that we deployed search in the past, because frankly, the database couldn't do it, but search as a way to bring together data and define a model that can intersect a highly diverse set of information. And if you think about it, right, if I issue a search for something and I get back this big giant wob of data, well, in that data, there's a bunch of metadata. And from that metadata, I can start to drive analysis. And so this was sort of the secret at Splunk, where we started to approach this idea of IT troubleshooting, and all of a sudden people were saying, wow, I just solved the cybersecurity threat that we've had. I was able to provide a compliance report. I was able to do all of these different things. And of course, in those days, we were thinking about machine data, in the Splunk days. Well, fast forward a bit, when I got excited about Lucid was that, okay, you had Apache Solr, which was the primary document store across the world, really. I mean, you look at different industries, 90% of the Fortune 100, you've got, I mean, deployments of Solr reaching the millions of applications worldwide. But meanwhile, there was this whole other movement starting to happen of people were starting to hoard information in the form of things like data lakes. And if you think about this sort of search as a way to just access this information that you may know little bits about, but you know the relevant keywords and terms, and maybe it's key value pairings that you need to retrieve the right model, you can start to then analyze and make sense of that. And so we see customers today with their Hadoop data lake storing every customer interaction, every transaction, every log, every purchase, and they're able to build very specific 360 views of any customer, of any service, of any product, using our search technology as a way to access that data and make sense of that data is really exciting. And this is where I think search is going to play a tremendous role in the future of big data, because frankly, you don't need an instruction manual to use Google, right? If I put you in front of that box, you're going to start to become productive with it. And the more kind of serendipitous experience that you get with that data, the more insight as a subject matter expert you're going to be able to extract from it. Sorry, it was a bit of a long rant, but I thought it would kind of tie some of this together.
That's all right. We like long rants. That gives us time to think about things. You've mentioned Apache Solr several times, and I'm sure there's a lot of us that are not real familiar with that. What is Apache Solr?
So Solr was an open source project started at CNET about 11 years ago to really provide search. So what is search? Well, and it's basic. I just went on the whole rant about what search can be in the future. But if you think about search at its fundamental basics, it's taking unstructured information, indexing that information, and then allowing you to use natural language to retrieve it. And Apache Solr was used or developed as a way at CNET to give users access to all of the content that CNET was creating. So CNET developed this project internally, ended up donating it to the Apache Foundation. A lot of people, as you can imagine, had very similar challenges where they said, wow, I really like to provide a index which can use human language to retrieve information on behalf of my users, started adopting this technology in a number of different areas. Companies like IBM and SAP started building products in and around that ecosystem. And what happened was there was a group of individuals who were sort of responsible, the committers, for really driving the development of that project. Well, as a project becomes successful, more and more companies become leveraged on it. They start reaching out for help and things of that nature. And so that was really how LucidWorks was founded. It was that group of committers that said, hey, you know, people really want enterprise level support for this open source search engine. People are looking for services and consulting. Let's go build a business around this. And that was sort of how we came into existence. And we have since evolved into a little more focused commercial offerings, which I can talk about later. But at its foundation, the company was built off of that Apache Solr project, which is, an open source search engine.
Okay. What license does that use? There's probably an easy answer here, but I'll ask it. What license is that?
The Apache license.
Yeah. Who'd have thought?
Yeah, you know, keep it simple.
Yes. So with the Apache license, how do you prevent, or do you prevent, do you care, Google from making a yellow box 2.0 that is Apache Solr?
You don't prevent it for sure. I mean, this is sort of all's fair in love and open source, we like to say. And so there's not a whole lot. And unlike other companies, like if I look at a company like Elastic or MongoDB or something of that nature, you know, they use open source really as sort of a freemium model, but it's not an Apache project. And so you have a lot more control over the code and you have a lot more protection around that. Being an Apache project, really anything goes. If Google decided tomorrow they're going to take Solr, they're going to build an appliance. If IBM or heck, even if some startup were to come into existence and decide that, you know, this is the way forward, they have every right to do that. If you look at what we've been doing with Fusion, what we recognized was that, look, there's a commoditized experience that people are able to get at open source. And, you know, different organizations will have different levels of comfort. And so we have folks that use us in a very basic fashion for commercial software. But the reality is that they're deploying this software for a purpose. And we did a lot of work to understand, okay, what are the primary use cases and domains in which our customers are trying to solve things or get things to market in which we can build enabling technology? And so Fusion provides a number of commercial sort of proprietary components that extend the open source to drive very specific functionality for their applications. And that's the comfort that we have when it comes to, you know, how will competitors leverage the open source technology? We'll let them, because frankly, the more that they're using, the more that they're contributing, we benefit from it just as our users do. But our goal is to be to continuously build very discrete offerings up the stack that provide a lot of efficiency and time to value and extended capabilities for customers in our sort of core use case areas.
Your commercial offerings, is it a physical appliance? Is there a box? Is there literally a Fusion box that someone can buy and put in? How does that work?
You know, it's funny. With the end of life of Google, that definitely was a question, right? Should we be just giving them something that they can just slide into that empty hole in their data center that the yellow box left? You know, the fact of the matter, and frankly, this has been the case now for, 10 years. But, you know, the reality is that people are moving away from wanting to deal with physical hardware of that nature. I'd say if you're dealing, you know, in the SMB, when you were deploying Google for your law firm of 20 lawyers and, you know, 50 people, sure, you go plug it into a closet and that was that. Within the enterprise today, with containerization and obviously virtualization and now cloud becoming a big piece of the infrastructure, that's just not a viable solution. And so we just deliver on-prem software. And we can do that as a virtual appliance. We can do it as Docker images and things of that nature to make it easier. But we have not gotten into shipping any physical hardware, thank goodness.
It's a big step. Do you have examples or thoughts on this idea of, because you guys started out as a developers and now you've moved into business, the balance between those two, how is that managed?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? In this day and age, I mean, developers are your champions. They're your decision maker. They're the economic buyer. I mean, they hold the keys to that organization. And so I think a lot of companies, and as a startup, it's a little bit easier to just come into the existence with this mentality. But even for more legacy enterprise companies, they're having to kind of change the way they go to market, right? Because, again, you're addressing this developer. There's a lot more transparency. Being open source, it's even beyond normal transparency because they can look at every bit of code. They can look at the conversations going on online. But that level of transparency means that you have to be creating a lot of value for that developer, obviously, where they say, look, with this technology, I'm going to do my job better. Now, the flip side of that is, who is it that they're servicing within the organization, right? Most companies, most, don't build applications because they like writing code. They build applications because they've got very specific needs within the business, or they're servicing a very specific user within the business. And so our ability to come in and provide the developer something that they're comfortable with, that is powerful enough to meet their needs, that is modern enough to meet their environments, meaning it can run in hybrid environments, it works across big data paradigms and those types of things, but more importantly, gives them then the tools that can help their business counterparts be successful, is sort of how we win, by kind of bringing those two things together. If we did one without the other, it really wouldn't matter, right? If I came out with a bunch of tools for business users to manage data experiences and to understand their data, and the developer says, wow, this is the worst piece of technology I've ever dealt with. I can't deploy it. I can't manage it. Well, that's not going to get us anywhere. On the flip side, you know, if the developer's like, man, it's got every latest and greatest hook and speed and feed, but provides little to no business value, we're not going to get anywhere there either, right? So you kind of, again, you want to drive that balance. I like to use the term of the customer's customer. Right. As a vendor, we want to understand is, what are we doing for the customer's customer? Because that's how we're going to make our customer successful.
Sure. So let's say new open source project wants to commercialize, wants to start a business. What do you say? What's your advice for right now for someone trying to make money with open source?
Gosh. So there's a lot of ways to answer that question. I'd say there's to break it down simply, and I promise to keep this one shorter. There's sort of three models that you see out there, and I'll tell you the one that I prefer, but it's not to say that you can't make the other ones work. The first model would be a pure kind of services type of organization where, you know, open source is out there, the bits are out there. I do little to try to monetize those bits, meaning I don't sell a license or anything. But what I do have is I offer training, I offer services through a consulting, and I offer enterprise support, which will be, hey, if the thing's broken, I can call you up and there's an SLA and, you know, the whole kind of throat to choke model. So with that, what you end up with is sort of a lack of stickiness, right? They can get support out there in the community. They might come to you when there's something that's urgent or really time sensitive. But the reality is they're not looking for any ongoing type of relationship with you. You really have to fight to defend those support contracts and things of that nature, which can make it really hard to operate the business. The second model would be something that's more along the lines of like a certified distribution, where you might say, look, yeah, there's the Apache thing or whatever you want to go get out in GitHub, but we have done some additional testing and hardening of the product, and we will support this specific distribution. And as long as you stick to our distribution, we're happy to offer you all of the support that you need. And again, there's an additional peace of mind beyond just getting something from pure open source. The third, which is one that we adopt, is commercial extension, commercial integration, right? People are deploying technology for a reason. Go understand where, you know, if you were to draw a Venn diagram where the densest pieces of use cases and capability overlap exist, and go build those things commercially, which can deploy against the open source. Now, we can get into this later, but there's a different balance you strike at that point about how do I determine whether something is going to be commercial versus going back into the open source? And our simple answer to that is that we like to look at very use case specific things that don't serve the broader audience of the open source, that are very specific for certain things that certain users are trying to do. Therefore, we can go off and try to monetize that portion of the community without causing any disruption or even frustration, I guess, with the rest of the open source community.
Okay. So how is this different? It sounds like it is, but I want to get your thoughts on it. How is this different than the open core idea?
So it actually is the open core idea, because what open core, and I think that's a term, funny enough, that hasn't really been given a firm definition. So my definition of open core is that everything we do extends from that open source base. So if you were to take Fusion and rip off all of the pieces, at some point you're going to find a completely unadulterated Apache Solr. Right. And that's Solr just as you know and love it. And as a developer, the APIs are the same, the deployment paradigms are the same, the architectural considerations are the same. So I have this thing that I know and that I trust, and then I can start to take advantage of these extensions that have been provided by the vendor. And so that's a true open core model where, you know, again, underneath the hood is the actual thing that I know to be open source. Where that's different is if I look at a technology like, let's say, Ativio, which is a commercial search vendor that runs an open source library at its very core, but there's no way for a developer to get at it. You really don't know that it's running. You can't take advantage of it, meaning that it's so hidden and wrapped underneath different layers of services and APIs that it may as well just be another proprietary solution. And so that's kind of the big difference here. And we're very big proponents of the open core model. We think it's very great. It's powerful for our go-to-market. It's important for our developers because, you know, with deploying Fusion, they're actually getting exposure to Apache Solr and having expertise in open source, especially today, from just a skills perspective, from a resume perspective, is really important.
Okay, that's probably the best defense of open core I've ever heard, and it sounds like it's promising. So let's say 12 months from now, a year from now, how does all this change?
Gosh, one thing that we're seeing for sure, and I think every vendor, open source or not, has to think about this in terms of how you go to market, is this preference for DIY, right? If you think about it 5 years ago, right, there was a real aversion to open source, which meant that there was an aversion to really building your technology stack from the ground up, right? They were purchasing a lot of commercial off-the-shelf software. You're relying on a lot of vendors and in some cases large system integrators coming in and helping you sort of achieve different things. Well, you opened the show talking about the importance of competitive differentiation, of advantage, and more and more organizations realize, and almost all of them probably realize it, but more and more are moving towards taking advantage of the fact that, you know, that technology is going to be that competitive advantage or will be that differentiator, which means more and more vendors are less, I guess, are willing to take more risk in terms of their technology. They're investing a lot more money and resources to do things themselves. And so with the abundance of open source technology and really powerful open source technology, mind you, if you think about what you can do with the Hadoop and Spark and a lot of this stuff and Solr and things that are out there, it's the same level of scale and complexity that you see from the, you know, most sophisticated companies in the Silicon Valley. And so this is just something that we have to constantly stay ahead of. And our goal is to enable the customer to do more through these components and these bits that we can deliver, not necessarily replace their expertise or try to get in front of their business, but to become a real enabler underneath. And I think going forward a year or two, 5 years from now, that position is going to become increasingly more important as people are sort of making the decision of whether I engage a vendor for a particular project or I completely go about it myself.
So last week, just to delve into this a little bit, this is like probably one of our favorite most necessary topics to discuss because there's so many different approaches to this the open source models and how you build your companies on them. Last week, Simon told us that, you know, MariaDB was actually taking one of their, I can't remember which one it is, but, you know, one of their components, and they were locking it down. And so it wasn't going to be completely open source anymore. And if you wanted to get that feature, you have to go out and pay them or whatever to get that lockdown feature. It became proprietary. So, when you were talking about the different open core or the way you define open core, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're exactly doing that. It sounds like you're more building on top of Apache Solr. And there's another one we should talk about too, which I think is Apache Lucene. Lucene, that's what it is. Thank you. So, but it sounds like you're building on top of that the way you would build on top of a LAMP stack. Is that right?
That's exactly it. In fact, that's a great analogy. And it's difficult, right? When I came into Lucid, I mean, Solr had already, you know, was already an Apache project. Obviously, Solr had been around for a significant amount of time, which means that it had a very rich set of features and capability, especially as it comes to things like scaling and elasticity and those types of kind of modern deployment architectures. And so thinking about, you know, how do I run across distributed environments and cloud environments and those kinds of things. And so we had to really look at the business and say, okay, what are the things that we can go build discreetly on top using that kind of LAMP stack analogy that you mentioned? other companies that are either earlier in their maturation or adoption, or frankly, in some cases, just aren't Apache, have taken a little more drastic approaches to this for understandable reasons. And so things like scaling, things like security, for instance. Now, this is where you start to bifurcate then, where do I contribute or donate back to the community versus where do I keep things commercialized? And that becomes a lot blurrier as you start to break out pieces of that core component. So to your point where you're not thinking about this as an open core of like, oh, I'm just going to keep building up the stack, but of, oh, I'm going to take, like, let's take security as a great example, that the security component will now become proprietary, meaning that there's no way to run this technology in a secure fashion without buying something from me. Well, frankly, in this day and age, if it's not secure, if it cannot be secured, it can't exist, right? I'd say the same thing about distributed, right? If it doesn't run in a distributed architecture, well, then is it really a thing? And so it's risky for companies to start to take those really kind of key components, if you will, that everybody comes to expect, and to remove those from the community. And you can see backlash. You can see the community sort of move away from your technology, and that's very risky. But on the flip side, those things being as critical as they are, if that's the hook that you can have to create that stickiness or that dependency back to the vendor, and you're able to survive that little disruption in the community, then frankly, it's a much easier way to go and monetize, because frankly, they simply cannot run the core technology without your assistance and without purchasing from you, which would question its open sourceness, I guess, if you would.
Right. And I think that's always the case, right? So anyone that's a proponent of open source and believes in the open source model, you know, this kind of conversation always feels like, I don't know, just a little icky or like somehow wrong, or somehow it rubs against the grain of, the open source way of looking at the universe, I guess. So we always talk about this a lot. Now, one question, DAW Desktop again had a question in the chat room. He says, do you have a plan to open up any of the extensions in the future? In other words, anything that, you know, the stuff that you're working on and developing on top of these other open source projects, are you have a plan on making those open source, or are they open source? Maybe some of it already is.
So today, everything that we've developed within the Fusion stack is proprietary, and we did that for a reason. So we've got that ability to go out and license software and really kind of grow the business that way. But as you can imagine, culturally, we're very obviously pro open source community, from everything from just, you know, the social impact that we believe in to what it does for the advancement of technology. And so we all often look for ways that we can contribute back. We still have a core team of about 12 folks that do nothing but work on Apache Solr all day. And every bit of work, every line of code that they write goes back into the open source, goes back out to the community. We participate or contribute to a number of other projects. Like Spark, I mentioned earlier, we've adopted Spark in a pretty major way. Through that, we've had to develop a number of components for doing natural language processing, for integrating into Solr. All of that we happily donate back into the community. The things that we're not entirely, and I'm just going to be totally transparent here, but that we think about but we're not entirely sure, are things like our connector framework. Right, connectors are obviously very valuable. We think that even the Solr community would benefit from a certain level of connectivity being available beyond what you get from, you know, there is a project called Tika that's out there. But if you think, you know, that really also is a core pillar of value in terms of why people are coming to us as a company or as a vendor. And so we just want to be thoughtful about it. But our goal would be to put as much stuff out there that we can. We also, I mean, the more that you put out, the more you get other people collaborating. We did a little analytics project about a year and a half ago to give people the ability to build dashboards and data visualizations on top of Solr. And today, you know, we've got about 50 folks from around the world that contribute code on a regular basis. Yahoo Japan has been a big contributor. We see folks from Bloomberg. We see folks from a number of really notable organizations that have actually contributed work back into this project, which then we benefit from as an organization, our customers benefit from. And so obviously there's a big advantage to that as well, being sort of integrated into the community better.
Yeah. And we should say that, I mean, it's not like you're just taking the code and building stuff on top of it. You're actually developing the code, as you mentioned earlier. You actually contribute a lot of code back to these projects, don't you?
We do. Yeah. For Solr, for instance, we contribute about 80% of every release is coming from our engineers.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that's a. I think this is okay. I always go back and forth a little bit. I know that there's some purists that don't like this model, but I think it's actually okay, especially when you're contributing code back to the projects that you're basing your platform off of. Exactly. It's not like you're just taking it all in. I mean, I look at companies like Apple and others who take, depending on the license that the code's written under, can take that stuff, use it, and then develop on it and never give back to the community, never give back to the projects that they're building off of. I shouldn't say never, right? But rarely. Let's say rarely.
It's hard. It's really hard. I mean, I've talked to people who've done a lot of great work and are saying, you know, I'd love to get this stuff contributed back, but literally I have to review every line of code with a lawyer before I'm able to do that. You can imagine the pain that would cause from somebody as you know, and typically this isn't even your day job, right? This is something that you're doing on the side. I will say though, and going back to the question about what do I see changing, we're seeing that level of comfort with open source has been increasing. I think if it was like written as a, you know, a curve, we're at this like extreme acceleration of companies. I mean, I can tell you, I talk every day with large banks, with healthcare, with insurance, with government, all adopting open source in a very major way. And one of the key things to adopting open source is actually attracting talent who's familiar with that project. And these companies that have been culturally opposed to contributing code, speaking at conferences, meetups, all of those things are now finding that in order to attract the talent that they need from the community, they've got to be open to community participation. Because as you said, for some people, this isn't even a question of like, you know, my job or whatever. These are things that I fundamentally believe in. And if you don't allow me to participate in a way that I believe in, then simply I'm not going to come work for you, which is a disadvantage to those companies that aren't willing to be a little more open-minded. And so we've seen an evolution pretty dramatically in the last couple years where companies are contributing code, where they're speaking publicly about what they're doing, about what technology these are using. And these are companies that have historically have been so tight-lipped that, you know, you knew kind of what was going on, but really had no idea in the ways that they were utilizing it, nor were they really big supporters of the community. And that's another thing that I think is really important for not just the you know, the companies that are out there that are not technology serving companies per se, but are utilizing a lot of open source. But even you have technology companies out there that are using open source in a pretty major way as part of their offering that contribute little to nothing back. And, you know, as a commercial entity behind one of these projects, I can tell you, you know, we do things like we host the conference. That's a huge outlay of finance for our company to support that community initiative. I would love to see, and we have some great sponsors and great people that are supporters of it, but I'd love to see more of the technology ecosystem that's leveraging solar participate in this conference, not because it's a Lucidworks event and they want to sponsor a Lucidworks conference, but to actually support the project in which they extract so much value from. And hopefully we'll start to see more of that. But like I said, I think the level of comfort with the idea of contribution and collaboration has increased just dramatically in recent years.
Well, I'm certainly glad to see that your company is contributing back. I mean, I think that's really important. And there's also another Apache project that you guys use, and we mentioned it a minute ago, called Lucene. I think I got it right this time. So how do you use Lucene?
So what is Lucene? Little technical here, but Lucene was a Java library that was developed by Doug Cutting, who also developed Hadoop. And it was made for basically indexing and retrieval within your Java applications. And so if you're, you know, a developer, you'd be familiar with, okay, I've got to like import com.lucene, like import this Lucene library, and then go write a bunch of code to use it in a way that makes sense for me. Well, what happened, going back to now how Solr was created, was that at CNET, basically they said, wow, this Lucene thing's very cool, but gosh, it'd be better if it ran more like a server. So kind of like a database where I have this server that's up there running and I can push data to it and I can retrieve data from it. And so CNET developed a server to sit on top of this Lucene library to make it more accessible and more usable as sort of the way that you would think about a database server, the way that you would utilize that. And that became the Solr project. And so Solr is Lucene with these extra things on top which allow it to just run as a standalone server. Versus if I was just writing a Java application and I wanted to index some data as part of that application, I could just take the Lucene library, import it into my app, and just start to use it deep and within my code base. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense, actually. That makes a lot of sense. I was thinking it was a separate project, but it's actually tied together with Solr.
Yeah, in fact, it's considered a top-level project, and then Solr stems down from Lucene if you look at the Apache structure.
Right, right. So how do I actually – we talked a lot about, you know, what the benefit is, what the software does for a company, how it ties into the open source community. How do you actually install this thing? Like, if I want to go out and put this thing in my company or whatever, we talked about servers. Do I need just to install? Is there a Debian package? Like, how hard is it to get this thing up and running?
It's, you know, a couple of clicks. So we've got an archive that you download from our website, and you can run this across your Mac, Windows laptop, Linux, and so it's just a package that you just unpack and bin run go, and it's up and running. And from there, there's a web interface that'll guide you through some setup and some of those kinds of things. We do offer an Amazon AMI. So if you want to run as an Amazon cloud, Amazon machine image in AWS, you can deploy us natively there. We'll be releasing a Docker container here shortly. We have some stuff today that customers are using, but we'll have that more publicly available. And you didn't hear it from me, but there may be a cloud offering in the future as well to make that whole deployment piece a lot easier for customers.
So you mean a cloud services offering. So instead of deploying it on my infrastructure, I just set up an account at lucidworks.com. And put in some information and go.
You got it.
Ooh, that sounds interesting. I like that you have an Amazon. At first, I was thinking, well, this is really only going to be applicable to install in a local, you know, your local data center. But actually, I mean, so many people have their apps running in Amazon, for example, right now, or other cloud services providers, that it makes sense. You're actually going to need that up in the cloud to be able to pull in that data unless you want to suck it down into your data center every night or something.
Which makes no sense. And you can think about, I mean, there's companies that I know that are operating in the $200 to $300 million in revenue that don't have a single piece of technology deployed on premise, especially out here in the Valley. Right. And so, you know, everything from my document repository to my CRM to my issues database to my ticketing system, all of these are hosted services, right? And I need access to all the data. I need search across all of that data to run my business. And what a lot of customers end up doing is they end up sucking all that information back down from the cloud, running something locally. We've even seen sillier cases where you suck it down from the cloud, proxy it locally, send it back up to another cloud, things of that nature. But you're absolutely right in that running, you know, part of being a modern technology company is sort of adapting to all of these this modern ecosystem, which is a lot more of the SaaS providers, cloud infrastructure providers, and so people run their entire businesses on Amazon and things of that nature. And we want to address that. And we built today the connectors and the capabilities around that. But we see that, you know, just having a push button running as a service being something on the horizon that would be really interesting to these customers that are simply just not consuming technology on premise.
Right, and it's a great way to get started, right? For customers that may be a little bit hesitant about how to do it.
No doubt. I mean, within 2 minutes, you sign up, you point at your data source, and you're cooking. I mean, it's funny enough that the challenge that you talked about at your job would be interesting to see if you'd be able to just go in. I don't know where the data sits or whatever, but to actually just quickly set something up and just say, hey, guys, look at this. I'm able to search all this data in a much more efficient way with a much more accurate relevancy experience than what we're doing currently.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other question I should talk about when we talk about implementation is scaling. So how does this thing scale? Is it node-based? Do you just add nodes and it knows that you've added a node and it shares information? How does that work?
It does. And so we utilize Zookeeper behind the scenes, the same as Hadoop, and you know, very battle-tested framework for managing sort of distributed workloads and deployments of that nature. And we simply scale horizontally, and so you can continue to add more capability. I'm sorry, you continue to add more capacity and spread the load across that capacity. There's some very interesting things you can do at a very granular level. So depending on your data and the nature of access around that data, you may tier the deployment and have, you know, kind of a hot, warm, cold type of scenario where I've got a set of information that I want to ensure that I have overcapacity for, that I can retrieve, you know, billions of results in sub-second time. And as that data becomes less relevant or less interesting, I can sort of age it out and make it less performant, which means I'm using less computing resources to process that data. And so it's very flexible in the way that you can kind of define the sort of performance requirements and balance that with economics from hardware and storage and all of those kinds of things.
Great, great. Well, there's lots of things that we could continue to talk about. We're just about out of time, and we're going to have to wrap it up, unfortunately. So Is there anything that we didn't ask that you want to let people know about?
Gosh, no, this has been great. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about search. You know, we talk about open source all day long, but this has been fantastic. And, you know, with that, I would say, like I said, I mean, buy your local open source committer a pizza, a beer, you know, send them a donation when you see an opportunity, attend the conference, sign up for a training. I mean, there's a lot of folks that are out here, not just companies, that are contributing a lot of time and effort to these technologies that are very important. I mean, these are especially around big data, the ability to just have social impact, economical impact. I mean, it's significant. And if it wasn't for these folks that were dedicating a lot of time and energy, we simply wouldn't be where we are today, technologically speaking. And so for anybody who's watching, and if you realize your company is using a lot of this free software, just figure out ways that you can contribute, whether it's your time, your effort, your code, going out and evangelizing, or monetarily, if your organization is capable of doing that.
Right. Yeah. Even hosting a meetup. I know that's something that we've done in the past at NetApp. Just, you know, we've got a big building. It's right in Sunnyvale. So, you know, the cafeteria isn't open, you know, at 7 o'clock at night or whatever. So they've got a big room and projectors, like just come in and have a meeting. And I think even doing something like that and maybe bringing some, you know, refreshing beverages.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Goes a long way. So, yeah, I'm with you absolutely 100% on that one. So, Will, thank you so much for being here today. There is a few last questions that we like to ask folks that come on the show. A lot of times we do have the developers or the project leads on the show. And so these are a little bit more technical questions. I'm going to ask them and see if you have a preference. So the first one is, what is your favorite scripting language?
Python. It's easy.
Nice. Yes, I love it. I love Python. I'm actually teaching my kids Python right now because they wanted to learn, you know, how to do write programs. And I said, well, let's start with Python. It's fairly
fantastic.
Easy, forgiving. Yeah. Second question is, what's your favorite editor?
Oh gosh, you know, I'm so basic. Now, the reality is that I'm, unfortunately, in my job, I don't get to spend as much time writing code as I'd like to. In fact, I do more at home with my Andrinos and things of that nature. I just use Text Wrangler. Like, I'm so basic like that. You know, I've looked at these other kind of cooler tools and the BB edits, and I never really got into IDEs. I mean, I used to write a lot of Java back at the beginning of my career, but once, you know, Python and all these other cool things came out and the IDEs weren't quite there, you just sort of got used to text editors. But yeah, I wish I had a cooler answer. I don't. I just, you know, by anything that can just do plain text with a little bit of syntax highlighting is good enough for me.
Yeah, I think that's fine. I mean, we got a lot of people that are still stick to either Vim or Randall's favorite Emacs. So,
not that hard,
you know, yeah, me neither. But we still get a lot of people that talk about that. You know, I've been using Atom a lot lately because it's kind of like in the middle. It's not like a full-blown IDE, but it's open source. So you can write modules. If you want it to do something cool, you can just write the module up and throw it in there.
That's cool.
And make it work. So, yeah, definitely. Oh, also, one last question. Any relationship to Dennis Hayes of Hayes Modem fame?
No, that's the first time I've gotten that. But no, I don't believe so. At least that's funny.
Oh, okay, I know Hayes is kind of a common name, but like whenever I hear the name Hayes, it makes me think of the early days. You know, the squeaks and squawks and all that kind of stuff that we used to have.
Yeah. Whoever asked that question is dating themselves a little bit.
Nice. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. Really cool. Product you're working on, and good luck to you and everybody else at LucidWorks.
Appreciate it. We'll hopefully see you guys again soon.
All right. So that's Will Hayes from LucidWorks. Jonathan, first thoughts on LucidWorks.
Very, very interesting interview. I enjoyed that one a lot. It is basically Google search for the enterprise, just as it says kind of on the tin. I appreciated his thoughts on open core, and that was perhaps the best I've ever heard anyone explain open core as something that makes sense and isn't evil. It's kind of got a bad rap, but it sounds like if done right, there is some good things about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that, like I said, it's a tricky subject, right? Because I think there are ways to do open core in a an ethical way, I guess, you know, as opposed to just picking off a project and incorporating it into yours and then not contributing back, not giving credit. Of course, you have to, if you use the project software inside of your software, of course, you have to follow the license requirements and things like that. But I mean, Yeah, I feel like this is maybe an okay way to do it. I don't know. I'm not as strict as other people are about this. I don't like seeing people, especially developers, taken advantage of, but it doesn't seem like they're doing that in this case. They're actually contributing a lot of the code back. They're developing the projects that they're basing their work on. And so I think this is a good way to do it. And it's why we had them on the show, quite frankly. If it was just a company that didn't have any connections to open source and weren't doing anything, then they wouldn't be on this show. They'd be on some other show. And so I think you're right. I think the way that he explained it and what they're doing definitely seems to be above board and probably the right way to do it when you have an important business reason to build a project like this on top of an open source code base. So really, really good stuff. And speaking of good stuff, we've got a lot of good stuff coming up on this show. How's that for transition? Next week, we're going to be talking to Pino DiCandia. He's going to be talking to us about Midacura, which is, again, an enterprise product. It's a virtual network management software built on the open source MitoNet project. So again, we've got something built for the enterprise, has to be supported in a certain way, but it's very closely related to a great open source project. And then on September 13th, Josh Berkus is coming back, this time to talk about Project Atomic. As we mentioned last week, Josh was one of the first guests on Floss Weekly. If you go back and look, I think it was episode number 6 or something. So very early on, he was on talking about PostgreSQL, I think. And now he's going to be talking about Project Atomic, which is, I like the way they describe this. It's using immutable infrastructure to deploy and scale your containerized applications on a next-generation container OS. So they've got some good marketing people that are spinning those words for him. But it really is something that we talk about a lot, is how to use containers. And I think this is the next step in the evolution, coming up with an OS that's built around containers. Really cool stuff. And then on September 20th, Jared Smith's going to be on talking, again, something topic related to the one we had today, which is Capital One open source. And this is a bank, obviously Capital One, that's actually contributing to open source. So we're going to find out how they interact with the open source community and the projects they're working on. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about this topic of commercial entities either using or supporting open source, which is incredibly important. I don't think open source would be where it is today without a lot of these great companies that are contributing back to the community. And that's it. That's what's coming up. So you definitely want to stay tuned. Jared, I've got Jared on the brain now. Jonathan, anything you want to plug?
I don't have a whole lot going on. I know we've got some interesting guests that we are we're talking to about the future, maybe even somebody from Arduino. So looking forward to that. But no, not a whole lot going on here that I can shout from the rooftops quite yet.
Okay, no problems. As far as I'm concerned, you can definitely follow me on social media. I'm on Google+. I post everything from Google+ out. And it goes to Facebook and Twitter, and a lot of people interact with me on Facebook and Twitter, and that's great. No problem with that at all. So definitely keep in contact and look at those things. And if you have I'm getting a lot of questions about Makerspace, which I founded a Makerspace here in my hometown of Benicia. It's growing like gangbusters, as my dad used to say, doing really well. If you're in the Northern California area, if you're close to especially if you're anywhere north of San Francisco or east of San Francisco and you want a good makerspace to join, or just come check out what we do. We have open spaces, open houses every other Monday. You can free time to come out and take a look at what's going on. And then as far as this show is concerned, you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter or Plus Floss Weekly on Google+. We do try to tweet out our shows when they come up. Right before we go live, we do use Twitter to say, hey, this show's about to start. So you can take advantage of that if you want to know when we're about to start. And then, of course, we'd love to take questions from the chat room. You can go to irc.twit.tv and take a look at that. And please contribute questions if you have any kind of questions about the topic that we're talking about or the software package that we're discussing or anything like that. We'd love to take questions from the audience. And, of course, you can always watch us live. We're live.twit.tv. So that was it. Great show. Thanks, everybody, for watching. And we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.